Welcome to the Not Old Better Show. I'm your host, Paul Vogelsang. As someone with autism spectrum disorder, John Elder Robison knows what it's like to feel emotionally removed from situations. John, author of the New York Times best-selling memoir, Switched On, explains to me that there's this emotional language you're missing. There are stories in people's eyes. There are messages.
The idea that they were going to do it by using high-powered magnetic fields, and I had worked as an engineer with high-power electronics and high-power electromagnets, and I thought, boy, I know all about what they're doing, which again was totally unfounded. Now I realize that as much as I wanted all my life to see into other people, what I was wanting was to be like everyone else. But you know, to be like everyone else is not really a formula for success. It's a formula for blending into the herd. And that's attractive at some level, but I think being different is what can make us stars.
John Robison didn't fully understand what that meant until he received transcranial magnetic stimulation, or TMS, which is a non-invasive procedure in which areas of the brain are stimulated with electromagnetic fields to alter its circuitry. By introducing current to the brain, doctors can probe the function of certain parts of the brain, and we can even modify how different parts of the brain work.
We'll stimulate your brain with this, and then we'll put you back in front and show you a bunch of different faces, and we'll see how you do after. And it seemed straightforward. And since they believed it would only last 15 minutes, they thought, well, whether it makes you better or worse, it's going to be a very short-lived effect. You'll be at the hospital for an hour after we've done it, and by the time you leave, any effects will be gone. And it didn't work out that way at all.
In today's interview, John details those treatments and the emotional waking that resulted and the amazing feelings that resulted in our conversation.
Feeling like I could look into the soul of somebody next to me. That was more disabling in a sense than being oblivious to the person next to me. The emotion of day-to-day interaction would reduce me to tears.
John Robison says that the treatments left him with a sense of empathy that he'd never experienced before. But he adds, not all the changes caused by TMS were welcome. Ordinary conversations would leave him feeling emotionally overwhelmed, and in some cases, his memories of past events were tainted.
From the time I learned about it, I had gradually come to understand that being autistic was part and parcel of my successes, but also part and parcel of my failure.
John Robison says of his autism and the resulting treatments and change, it's like I lost a protective shield. And while John Robison wasn't blind or deaf before this miraculous change, the treatment left him with the ability to read emotions. And he's here to talk about how his life suddenly changed and what he believes took place.
I believe that that's really our greatest duty, to try and develop tools that can relieve human suffering while enhancing our gifts and abilities. When we say we want our children, we want any group of people to have the best quality of life, I think we mean that we want to maximize happiness and we want to minimize suffering. And being able to connect with other people is an elemental thing that relieves human suffering.
Using transcranial magnetic stimulation, TMS, doctors hope to activate neurological pathways in John's brain that would deepen his emotional intelligence. John learned much and has been giving back ever since.
What did TMS teach me? When I could suddenly see into people after a lifetime of not doing that, And I had a lifetime of experience of before, and now I have experience of after. So which would I choose? What would I want? And while I think that if I was young again and you could have done something to me to turn on the ability to make friends, so I could have had a girlfriend when I was 13 so that the guys would have wanted me on their team, I would have been popular. I would have wanted that more than anything in the world. But you know, being alone is what caused me to go to the computer science lab at the University of Massachusetts and spend all those thousands of hours studying engineering. And in truth, I now see that my social disability facilitated what became an extraordinary technical gift. And that's what gave me my freedom.
Please join me in welcoming John Elder Robison to the Not Old Better Show. John, of course, is the author of the New York Times best-selling memoir, Switched On.
Welcome to the Not Old, Better podcast. It's time for this week's featured guest, on the Not Old Better podcast. And now your host, Paul Vogelzang.
Well, welcome to the Not Old Better show, and we're here tonight in downtown Washington, D.C. on the eve of a set of classes on neural diversity, but we're with author John Elder Robison. And John is the author of a relatively new book called Switched On. And I think it's a fascinating book, John. I just had to imagine myself, you know, kind of living without, you know, one of my senses. And then one day having that sense just kind of switch on. And suddenly, for the first time, maybe I have a sense of being able to see some color. And John, you know, you certainly know what that feels like. You weren't blind or deaf, but you had this really miraculous change. And you have Asperger's at the same time, a form of autism that really left you without the ability to read emotions. And John's here with us tonight to talk a little bit about his life and how it changed and his book Switched On. John, welcome to the Not Old Better show. Can you tell us a little bit about what you mean by the term Switched On and what that title really represents?
Well, first of all, I and most every autistic person that I know, we feel things quite deeply. And modern scientific research suggests that we are actually affected more deeply and for longer periods of time by emotional triggers than folks who aren't autistic. But having said that, there are many, many situations that have happened in my life where a non-autistic person would have had a certain emotional response. They would have shared another person's joy or pain or jealousy or excitement or happiness, and I just kind of stood there and looked. And that doesn't mean that I wasn't capable of feeling the emotions. What it means is that I didn't feel them in that context. So I took part in a series of experiments at Beth Israel Hospital in Boston, a teaching hospital of Harvard Medical School, that was aimed at switching on that ability. And when it was switched on in me, even temporarily, it produced what appears to be lasting and significant change in how I engage the world.
And so when you talk about kind of this idea of switching on, it's really that you kind of miss cues that others of us with some of this already switched on would see and have that trigger a response or a intuitive kind of thought and be able to know.
Right. Before the experiments, I might have looked at you and discerned nothing. And then afterwards, I might have looked at you in the same circumstance and thought, oh, he's really anxious. And I, not only would I have thought he's really anxious, I would have said something. I said, it's okay. You don't have to worry. We're going to be all right here. And so in that sense, I would have done the right thing instinctively. And before, I would have done nothing. And it's not that I don't care about you or I like you more or I like you less. It's that suddenly I had the ability to see and respond to that thing that I could not see before. And the other thing that I know is that you said in your introduction, well, you know, I've read this book and I now can see what it's like, but I now know that maybe you can see what it's like for me and maybe you can't, because I went from being able to perceive very little to having an almost ESP-like intuitive sense of other people to having that fade largely away and then come back again. And I now realize that the people around me have tremendously different abilities to see these things, and I realize that their ability to see things in other people is shifting up and down all the time. It's a very dynamic world, and I never imagined that. So I guess I now know that we're in more uncharted waters reading each other than I ever thought possible.
So let's go back to that invitation from Beth Israel Hospital. What was your reaction when you got that invite?
It's funny. They didn't actually invite me to join the study. They said, you're out speaking to groups of autistic people, and we wonder if we could put some flyers out at your talk, because maybe there'll be some autistic people in the audience that would be interested in this study that we're doing. And I asked what it was about. And first, when they said they were studying the possibility that maybe they could improve what you might call emotional insight into other people, they had no way of knowing that that was something that I had come to feel was a key component of disability in me. So they just happened to walk in with the thing that I felt I was missing. And of course, now I know that that's wishful thinking or a delusion, but that's what I believed at the time. And the idea that they were going to do it by using high-powered magnetic fields. And I had worked as an engineer with high-power electronics and high-power electromagnets, and I thought, boy, I know all about what they're doing, which again was totally unfounded, but my ignorant self-assurance caused me to jump in with both feet and be confident, and it turned out okay.
Well, really, you have very much an engineering kind of orientation. And with your experience in sound and with your experience in kind of this idea of electromagnetic, you may have thought that this process was something that you could kind of even reason through, as opposed to kind of really thinking this might cause something that I don't want to have happen.
Well, I understood the physics of how it worked. I understood that if you discharged an electromagnet next to my head, you would induce tiny electrical currents in the wires between the brain cells below the magnet. So I knew in principle that if you had a magnet that generated a field the size of a golf ball, you could induce tiny electrical currents in a golf ball size area of my head. And that's a kind of a significant thing, because the brain's an electrical organ. And so when we give somebody a psychiatric medicine, the medicine has to go into their digestive system, into the bloodstream, from there into the brain, and it goes all through the brain. Of course, that's why you have all these unwanted side effects, because to rebalance one area of your head, it shifts the balance all through the brain and it imbalances other stuff. The idea that we could change that balance directly with electromagnetism and we could fire it right where we want it, that's a cool idea. The question, of course, is, do we have enough knowledge in neuroscience to know where we want to fire it? And I guess for that, I had to trust that these Harvard scientists were the best in the world, and maybe that was a foolish notion, or maybe it was a wise notion, but I trusted them and jumped in.
And so you jumped into this therapy known as TMS.
Transcranial magnetic stimulation, which is, it's actually a therapy that's FDA approved for pain relief and migraines. It's used in stroke recovery. It's used in over 1,000 centers in the United States now to treat depression. And it has a lot of other applications in the pipeline. So this was one thing being studied that this tool can be used for.
And so the idea behind the Beth Israel study was that it really needed to kind of investigate this area of Asperger's and autism and see if this could actually be switched on.
The idea of seeing if we could switch on the ability to connect with people emotionally, that's a powerful thing. Mm-hmm. There are other studies happening right now where researchers are using TMS to study whether they can improve executive function in autistic people, the ability to organize one's life. It's obviously useful in treating depression and anxiety. It's being explored to help people with language challenges. Mm-hmm. So there are many different ways in which autism could disable us that could be subject to help through TMS technology. Mm-hmm. But it is absolutely not a cure for autism. It doesn't make me any less autistic than I ever was. It gives me perhaps an ability I didn't have before.
So these were really kind of three studies that kind of took place in your life, is that right?
I took part in a half a dozen studies over a period of 3 years.
Okay.
But the studies that really affected how I think were all aimed at the same thing, which was emotional insight.
Mm-hmm. And really, as a result of some of the work, some of this is kind of worn off, right? I mean, it's not, doesn't have lasting effects.
Well, that's an interesting thing. The scientists believed before we started the experiments that any effects on how I thought would only last for half as long as the time they stimulated. So they thought if they stimulated me for half an hour in a certain area, they would have 15 minutes to test me afterwards. And the thinking was, we'll put you in front of a computer and have you recognize expressions on a computer monitor as they fly by, push buttons for what you're seeing. We'll stimulate your brain with this, and then we'll put you back in front and show you a bunch of different faces, and we'll see how you do after. And it seemed straightforward. And since they believed it would only last 15 minutes, they thought, well, whether it makes you better or worse, it's going to be a very short-lived effect. You'll be at the hospital for an hour after we've done it, and by the time you leave, any effects will be gone. And it didn't work out that way at all. And in fact, there were some direct effects in those 15 minutes, but the effects of those stimulations kind of snuck up on me on the drive home and during the night. So mm-hmm. 3 to 12 hours later, I had these really powerful effects, almost like hallucinations. Mm-hmm. And it was after those that I was able to read emotional cues, to see into people, to read, to sense feelings in music, to sense feelings in the pages of a newspaper like the Washington Post and New York Times, which I never could before.
Through this process of, you know, kind of this awakening and you're sensing some of these feelings and ability to kind of understand some cues, and it must have been overwhelming for somebody that didn't have anything before to suddenly have all this.
It was, and also the idea that it frankly wasn't supposed to happen. But a day after the stimulation, feeling like I could look into the soul of somebody next to me, absolutely, that was more disabling in a sense than being oblivious to the person next to me. The emotion of day-to-day interaction would reduce me to tears. And I would talk to you and you would say, well, you're worried about, you know, your son's not doing well in school. Or, you know, your cat didn't come home last night. I would think, oh, excuse me, I got to go outside and compose myself. And it would be, and you would like think I was crazy if I said it to you, but that's what happened. And then to have that begin to dissipate, and I thought, well, I've got this ability, but now it's fading away, and what's going to happen now? Am I going to end up with less than I started with? So you could imagine it was a scary time. Yeah, absolutely. And then it began to just build on its own in a different way, and that's what remains today.
And so was it about that time that you kind of decided that maybe Asperger's is a gift?
I had recognized that Asperger's conferred a mix of disability and gift upon me. From the time I learned about it, I had gradually come to understand that being autistic was part and parcel of my successes, but also part and parcel of my failures, many of socially. So I could see it in both. I always thought that because I was oblivious to other people and I couldn't connect effectively with people, I thought, you know, I'm lonely, I'm sad. If only I could see those messages of love and sweetness and light, I would be happy. I would be fixed, if you will. And when I could read these signals from other people, of course, it wasn't at all what I had fantasized. It wasn't sweetness and light. It was greed and avarice and jealousy and angst and worry. And there was a little bit of beauty and sweetness and light. But what they say about the news being full of bad news, I think that's reflective of the reality of the emotional stream in life.
Mm-hmm. And your life, it's really taken on kind of an interesting turn, because from someone who had maybe been reluctant to be in and amongst people and maybe more comfortable even kind of alone. And now you are teaching at William & Mary. You work very closely with the federal government here in Washington, D.C. on committees. You have a very visible public role. So it's an interesting kind of change.
That to me is the most striking evidence of the power of this change in a good way for me, because you can look at what I did before in my life. If you read, for example, Look Me in the Eye, and you read about the stuff I did in the first 50 years, I was successful at designing rock and roll equipment, at designing electronic games, at photography, at writing books, at auto mechanics. But basically, those were solitary pursuits. They were things I was in charge, and I just did them. Today, if you look at what I've done since these TMS experiments, I am successful in group environments, like you say, William & Mary, in these federal government committees, which would be the most difficult thing to take part in that one could imagine, right? A federal bureaucracy. And yet, I'm successful at that, even though in my pre-TMS, pre-awareness life, I failed at those kinds of things repeatedly. So it would be easy to say, well, you know, I could have done that before if only I had had the opportunity. But, you know, I tried. I tried to work in companies and I couldn't. And I tried to work in groups and I couldn't.
And so I guess out of that, you and I have had a chance to talk a little bit. And I'm privileged in being joined by my wife, Gretchen, tonight. And Gretchen and I have a son who is autistic and has suffered his whole life from some of these same kind of debilitating, you know, pursuits and failures. And so I guess there's a real message of hope here.
Well, I think that there is a message of hope. I think we have to be careful when you say your son suffers from some of these things. There would be autistic advocates who would say, who are you to say he suffers? How do you know he suffers? But of course, I as an autistic person would be the first to say, absolutely, I have suffered a great deal in my life. And then the idea that your autistic son doesn't suffer, I think frankly that would be delusional to think that any of us doesn't suffer. That doesn't mean that we can't do great things. It doesn't mean we don't have great gifts. But I believe that that's really our greatest duty, to try and develop tools that can relieve human suffering while enhancing our gifts and abilities. When we say we want our children, we want any group of people to have the best quality of life, I think we mean that we want to maximize happiness and we want to minimize suffering. And being able to connect with other people is an elemental thing that relieves human suffering.
I think, Gretchen, you watched as Taylor had some moments of real pain.
Certainly a lot more than moments, you know, and I think as he got older and the social scene through, you know, preteen, teen, going through junior high and high school became more and more difficult. And we witnessed him, you know, kind of shutting down and having some real struggles. And I think conventional public school was a real difficult scenario for him. I think in hindsight, and of course as a parent, there's a lot of hindsight, you know. I think hindsight, we should have probably sought an alternative educational environment for him. But we didn't, because we didn't really know. And I think for parents, I mean, as a parent, I enjoy listening to what you have to say, John, because it does give me some hope, and it does make me understand a little bit more about where Taylor is coming from. When we started down this path, there wasn't a whole lot of information out there because this was about 20 years ago. And as a parent, having no prior, you know, experience with any of this, I felt like I was being constantly blindsided by these issues and these things that I needed to deal with. And my first instinct as a parent, I think any parent would be to, you know, try and fix it. But yet it's not something that's fixable, you know. So you walk down many, many roads as a parent when you have a child that has autism and Asperger's. I wish there was more out there when we were going through this at the very beginning. Now he's 23 and we're at a point now where we're starting to really get a hold on where he is going to go as a human being and what he wants to do. But
ultimately, he's got to find the direction. That's the thing. As much as we parents can wish for that for our kids, it's us individuals that have to find our ways. And indeed, even though people may wish that they could fix us, we're really not broken. We just are. I guess I think that sometimes people equate it with a disease. You know, they wish that we didn't have this drinking problem, or they wish that we didn't have this cancer. But it's not subject to a cure. It's just how we are. And I think that there's a real concern that when people express a desire for cure towards us, it implies that the way that we are is bad. And there is, in fact, nothing we can do to make ourselves not autistic. And I think we have to be very careful about that in talking to autistic people. But having said that, I do think that we, and I mean autistic people like me and non-autistic researchers, we can absolutely develop tools to help us understand ourselves, to help us understand other people, to help us therefore have a better quality of life by connecting better with people. And this research is illustrative of the sorts of promise the future holds. But you know, there's another side to it, because that's only what could TMS do to help an autistic person see people. Another thing that you could say is, what did TMS teach me? When I could suddenly see into people after a lifetime of not doing that, and I had a lifetime of experience of before, and now I have experience of after. So which would I choose? What would I want? And while I think that if I was young again and you could have done something to me to turn on the ability to make friends, so I could have had a girlfriend when I was 13 so that the guys would have wanted me on their team, I would have been popular, I would have wanted that more than anything in the world. But you know, being alone is what caused me to go to the computer science lab at the University of Massachusetts and spend all those thousands of hours studying engineering. And in truth, I now see that my social disability facilitated what became an extraordinary technical gift. And that's what gave me my freedom. Making friends didn't make me free of my home environment and a crummy life. And it didn't put me on my own. It was technical ability. And that came really through autistic difference. And some of that difference absolutely was disability, some was gift. Now I realize that as much as I wanted all my life to see into other people, What I was wanting was to be like everyone else. But you know, to be like everyone else is not really a formula for success. It's a formula for blending into the herd. And that's attractive at some level. But I think being different is what can make us stars. And so I guess now I have to say to people, you got to be really careful what you hope for, because maybe it's not what you think it is.
John, tell us a little bit about the program at William & Mary and your role, because it's a very interesting role and it's a very academic leadership role for a person who isn't necessarily rooted in that very traditional academic world.
Well, you might say that, but our provost would disagree. Actually, I'm the neurodiversity scholar at William & Mary. That's an unusual title in American academia. And the reason I'm called a neurodiversity scholar is that my 8th grandfather founded the church in Bruton Parish. And he also held the pulpit in the colonial capital in Jamestown at the church there. So he was arguably the most influential Anglican clergyman of his day in Virginia. And his son was one of the first proteges of James Blair, the founder of William & Mary. And after being educated by Blair, he became the first American-trained faculty at this school. And to distinguish the American faculty from the English masters, the American-trained faculty were the scholars in residence. So I am named that in honor of my 7th grandfather, the first scholar of this institution. As for why neurodiversity, the idea is that at William & Mary, we take pride in graduating a very high percentage of our students into public service. And one of our goals is not only to make our campus friendly and accepting for neurodivergent students, just as our campus is accepting of students of different races, different sexual orientations, different religious beliefs. We want to teach all of our students of the value of neurodivergent people and the value of the concept of neurodiversity. That somebody who's autistic, for example, who sees the world differently, if 10 people try and solve a problem and they can't see the answer because they think a certain way, maybe that autistic person, the answer will be obvious to him. Now, perhaps that autistic person will need help with 10 other things in a row. But you know what? If he does the one thing nobody else can do, he's a valuable part of the tribe. And our goal at William & Mary Neurodiversity is to show that to our students so that they go out in the world and they bring those values into government service, into service in our government, and in business and communities around the country. I think that's a really, really important thing.
I think so. John, thank you so much for joining us tonight. Certainly, as a parent, I've learned a lot. The book Switched On is wonderful, and your story is just a beautiful story. And so we really appreciate hearing from you. If people want to find you online, where do they do that?
They can just Google John Elder Robison, and I have a lot of stuff that I write that you'll find. I have a blog on Psychology Today, one on Blogger. I'm John Elder Robison on Facebook and John Robison on Twitter. I'm easy to find online.
And a New York Times bestseller of the book Switched On. So thank you again, John, for joining us. Really appreciate it. Have a great weekend, and we'll follow up with you.
Thank you.